and when His Grace took all the skin off my back 3 days ago. She was out in the ward to watch.
Ethan dropped his face into his hands and wept like a child. For a moment, Mathin sat there, frozen. Then he reached out a timid hand and laid it on Ethan's shoulder, until at last he fell silent and wiped his face roughly on his sleeve.
Maybe I shouldn't be too hard on her.
Ethan's voice was a flat, dead whisper.
She did keep her brother from killing me.
He stood up, and it was painful to watch him wince as he hauled himself to his feet.
I've rested enough. Let's ride, Matho. The farther I get from Cantray, the happier I'll be.
For 4 days, Mathin and Ethan rode west, asking cautious questions of the various farmers and peddlers that they met about the local lords and their warbands. Even though they sometimes heard of a man who might be desperate enough to take them in without asking questions, each time they decided that they were still too close to Cantray to take the risk of petitioning him. They realized, however, that they would have to find some place soon, because all around them the noble-born were beginning to muster their men for the summer's fighting. With troops moving along the roads, they were in a dangerous position. Mathin had no desire to escape being hanged for an outlaw, only to end up on a rope as a supposed spy. Since Ethan's back was far from healed, they rode slowly, stopping often to rest, either beside the road or in village taverns. They had at least no need to worry about coin. Not only did Mathin have Nevin's generous pouch, but Ethan's old captain had managed to slip him money along with his gear when he'd been kicked out of Dun Cantray. Apparently, Mathin wasn't alone in thinking the Gwerbret's sentence harsh. During this slow progress west, Mathin had plenty of time to watch and worry over his old friend. Since always before Ethan had watched over him, he was, after all, some 10 years Mathin's elder, Mathin was deeply troubled to realize that Ethan needed him the way a child needs his father. The Gwerbret might have spared his life, but he'd broken him all the same. This man who'd served him faithfully for over 20 years, by half-beating him to death like a rat caught in a stable. Always before, Ethan had had an easy way with command, making decisions, giving orders, and all in a way that made his fellows glad to follow them. Now he did whatever Mathin said, without even a mild suggestion that they might do otherwise. Before, too, he'd been a talkative man, always ready with a tale or a jest if he didn't have serious news to pass along. Now he rode wrapped in a black hiraeth. At times he didn't even answer when Mathin asked him a direct question. For all that it ached Mathin's heart, he could think of nothing to do to better things. Often he wished that he could talk with Nevin and get his advice, but Nevin was far away, and he doubted if he'd ever see the old man again, no matter how much he wanted to. Eventually they reached the great river, the Camin Erain, an iron road even then, because all the rich ore from Caer Gonny came down it in barges, and the town of Gathmir, at that time only a large village with a wooden palisade around it for want of walls. Just inside the gate they found a tavern of sorts, basically the tavernman's house, with half the round ground floor set off by a wickerwork partition to hold a couple of tables and some ale barrels in the curve of the wall. For a couple of coppers, the man brought them a chunk of cheese and a loaf of bread to go with their ale, then left them strictly alone. Mathin noticed that none of the villagers were bothering to come to the tavern with them in it, and he remarked as much to Ethan.
"For all they know, we're a couple of bandits." "Ah, by the hells, Matho, we can't go wandering the roads like this, or we might well end up robbing travellers at that. What are we going to do?" "Cursed if I know. But I've been thinking a bit. There's those free troops you hear about. Maybe we'd be better off joining one of them than worrying about an honourable place in a warband." "What?"
For a moment some of the old life came back to Ethan's eyes.
"Are you daft? Fight for coin, not honour. Ye gods, I've heard of some of the troops switching sides practically in the middle of a battle if someone offered them better pay. Mercenaries, they're naught but a lot of dishonoured scum."
Mathin merely looked at him. With a long sigh, Ethan rubbed his face with both hands.
"And so are we. That's what you mean, isn't it, Matho?" "Well, you're right enough. All the gods know that the captain of a free troop won't be in any position to sneer at the scars on my back." "True spoken. And we'll have to try to find one that's fighting for Caermore or Eldith, too. Neither of us can risk having some country man seeing us in camp." Ah, horseshit and a pile of it. Do you know what that means? What are we going to end up doing? Riding a charge against the Guerbre and all my old band some day?
Madden had never allowed himself to frame that thought before, that some day his life might depend on his killing a man who'd once been his ally and friend. Athan picked up his dagger and stabbed it viciously into the table.
Here!
The tavern man came running.
No need to be breaking up the furniture, lads.
Athan looked up so grimly that Madden caught his arm before he could take out his rage on this innocent villager. The tavern man stepped back, swallowing hard.
I'll give you an extra copper to pay for the damage, Madden said. My friend's in a black mood today. He can go about having it in some other place than mine. Well and good, then. We finish your piss-poor excuse for ale, anyway.
They'd just reached the door when the tavern man hailed them again. Although Athan ignored him and walked out, Madden paused as the taverner came scurrying over.
I know about one of them troops you and your friend was talking about.
Madden got out a couple of coppers and jingled them in his hand. The taverner gave him a gap-toothed, garlic-scented grin.
They wintered not far from here, they did. They rode in every now and then to buy food, and we was fair terrified at first, thinking they were going to steal whatever they wanted. But they paid good coin, I'll say that for them, for all that they was an arrogant lot, strutting around like lords. Now, that's luck. Well, now, they might have moved on by now. Haven't seen them in days, and here's the blacksmith's daughter with her belly swelling up, and even if they did come back, she wouldn't even know which of the lads it was. The little slut, spreading her legs for any of them that asked her.
Indeed. And where were they quartered?
They wouldn't be telling the likes of us that, but I'll wager I can guess well enough. Just to the north of here, oh, about 10 miles, I'd say, is a stretch of forest. It used to be the Tyrant's hunting preserve, but then, 20-odd years ago it was now, the old Tyrant and all his male kin got themselves killed off in a blood feud, and with the wars so bad and all, there was no one else to take the domain. So the forest's gotten all overgrown and thick-like, but I wager that the old Tyrant's hunting lodge still stands in there some place.
Madden handed over the coppers and took out 2 more.
I don't suppose some of the lads in the village know where this lodge is.
He held up the coins. It seems likely that some of the young ones might have poked around in there, just out of curiosity.
Not on your life, and I'm not saying that to get more coin out of you neither. It's a dangerous place, that stretch of trees. Haunted, they say, and full of evil spirits as well, most like. And then there's the wild men.
The what?
Well, I suppose that by rights I shouldn't call them wild, poor bastards, because all the gods can bear witness that I'd have done the same as them if I had to.
He leaned closer, all conspiratorial.
You don't look like the sort of fellow who'll be running to our lord with the news, but the folk who live in the forest are bondsmen, or I should say they was a while back. Their lord got killed, and so they took themselves off to live free, and I can't say as I'll be blaming them for it neither.
Nor more can I. Your wild men are safe enough from me, but I take it they're not above robbing a traveller if they can.
I think they feels it's owing to them, like, after all the hard work they put in.
Madden gave him the extra coppers anyway, then went out to join Athan, who was standing by the road with the horse's reins in hand.
Done gossiping, are you?
Here, Athan, the taverner had some news to give us, and it just might be worth following down. There might be a free troop up in the woods to the north of us.
Athan stared down at the reins in his hand and rubbed them with weary fingers.
Ah, horseshit, he said at last. We might as well look them over then.
When they left the village, they rode north, following the river. Although Athan was well on the mend by then, his back still ached him, and they rested often. At their pace, it was close to sunset when they reached the forest, looming dark and tangled on the far side of a wild meadowland. At its edge, a massive marker stone still stood, doubtless proclaiming the trees the property of the long-dead clan that once had owned them.
"I don't want to be mucking around in there when it's dark," Athan said. "You're right enough. We'll camp here. There's plenty of water in the river."
While Athan tended the horses, Madden went to gather firewood at the forest edge. A crowd of wild folk went with him, darting around or skipping beside him. A gaggle of green, warty gnomes, 3 enormous yellow creatures with swollen stomachs and red fangs, and his faithful blue sprite, perching on his shoulder and running tiny hands through his hair.
"I'll have to play us a song tonight. It's been a while since I felt like music, but maybe our luck is turning."
Yet, when it came time to play, Madin's heart was still so troubled that he found it hard to settle down to one ballad or declamation. He got the harp in tune, then played scraps and bits of various songs, or practiced runs and chordings. Athan soon fell asleep, lying on his stomach with his head pillowed on folded arms, but the wild folk stayed to the last note, a vast crowd of them, stretching out beyond the pool of firelight across the meadow. Madin felt awed, as if he were playing in a king's court, the great hall crowded with retainers. When he stopped, he felt more than heard a ripple of eerie applause. Then suddenly, they were gone. Madin shuddered profoundly, then put the harp away. After he banked the campfire, Madin paced a little ways into the meadow out of restlessness and nothing more. He could see the forest edge, looming dark not far from them, and even more, he could feel its presence, like an exhalation of wildness. He was sure that more than human fugitives lived there. It occurred to him that while the long wars were a tragedy for human beings, to the wild folk they were a blessing, giving them back land that men had once taken and tamed. As he stood there in the silent meadow, it seemed that he heard faint music, an echo of his own. Again he shuddered convulsively, then hurried back to his safe camp. On the morrow, the blue sprite woke him just at dawn by the expedient method of pulling his hair so hard that it hurt like fire. When he swatted at her, she laughed soundlessly, exposing her needle-sharp teeth. Nearby, Athan was still sleeping, but restlessly, turning and stretching like a man who'll wake any moment.
"Listen carefully, little sweet one," Madin said to the sprite. "Somewhere in that forest are a whole lot of men like me and Athan, warriors with swords. They'll have lots of horses, too, and they live in a stone house. Can you lead me there?"
She thought for a long moment, then nodded her agreement and promptly disappeared. Madin decided that either she'd misunderstood or had simply forgotten, but as soon as they were ready to ride, she reappeared, dancing and leaping on the riverbank and pointing to the north.
"I don't suppose that misbegotten tavern man gave you any directions to this place," Athan said.
"Well, he had a confused idea or two. I'll try to lead us there, but don't be surprised if it's a bit roundabout."
It was a good thing that Madin had put in his warning, because the wild folk's idea of leading someone left much to be desired. As soon as the men started riding north, two grey gnomes appeared to join the sprite, but they kept pinching either her or each other and distracting her both ways from her task. Once they were all well into the forest, the wild folk disappeared, leaving the men to follow a rough deer track for several miles. Just when Madin had given up on them, they flashed back into being, perching on his horse's neck and saddle peak, and pointing off to the west down a narrow and rough track indeed. Although Athan grumbled, and a welcome sign of returning life it was, Madin insisted on following it, and every time the path branched, he faithfully went the way she pointed. By noon, Madin was hopelessly lost, with no choice but to follow where the wild folk led. Hopping from tree to tree, they grinned, giggled, and pointed in various directions, but Madin always followed the blue sprite, who threatened to bite the grey fellows whenever they contradicted her.
"Matho, I hope to every god and his horse that you know what you're doing."
"So do I. I've got the ugly feeling I may have gotten us lost in here."
Athan groaned with a drama worthy of a bard. Just as Madin was thinking that he'd spoken the bitter truth, the sprite led them to a big clearing, ringed round with stumps of trees. Out in the middle was a hut built of logs, piled up whole to form a square structure, a house different from any that Madin had ever seen. The roof was neatly thatched with branches, and a wisp of smoke trailed lazily out of the smoke hole in the roof.
"What in the three hells have you found?" Athan sputtered. "That's not big enough for a band of mercenaries."
"So it's not. More likely it's some of those runaway bondsmen the taverner mentioned."
At the sound of their voices, a man came out. He was one of the shortest men Madin had ever seen, not more than 5 feet tall, but he had broad shoulders and heavy arms like a miniature blacksmith, and his legs were in perfect proportion to the rest of him. His long black beard trailed past the round collar of the wool tunic he wore over Brigger. He carried a long woodsman's axe like a weapon. When he spoke, his voice was rough with a heavy guttural accent.
"Just who are you, lads?"
"Naught but a pair of lost travellers," Mathin said.
"Thieves, more like."
The fellow hefted the axe.
"And what brought you into these wretched woods in the first place?"
"We were looking for a mercenary troop,"
Athan broke in. "A tavern man in Gazimir said there might be one quartered in this forest."
"All we want to do is see if they'll take us on," Mathin said. "I swear it, we're not thieves, and I don't know what a hermit like you would have that's worth stealing anyway."
The man considered with his axe at the ready. When Mathin noticed the blade, he nearly swore aloud in surprise. Although the metal gleamed exactly like silver, it had an edge as sharp as steel by the look of it, and it carried not one nick or bite.
"Now here," Athan said, "we'll be more than glad to leave you alone, if you'll only show us the way out of these blasted woods."
"Go back the way you came, of course."
"Good sir, we're lost,"
Mathin said, and quickly, because he didn't like the black look on Athan's face.
"Indeed, you found me easily enough."
"Well, I was following one of the..."
Mathin broke off just in time. As if she knew he was thinking of her, the blue sprite popped into existence, settling on his shoulder and kissing his hair. The fellow frankly stared and lowered his axe to lean on it like a walking stick. Quickly he darted a conspiratorial glance at Athan, who of course had seen nothing, and then gave Mathin a grudging smile.
"Well, perhaps I could take you to the old lodge after all, but your horses look worn out from all those wretched trees. There's a spring over there by that bit of stump. Give them a drink first. My name's Otho, by the by."
"And I'm Mathin, and this is Athan. My thanks for your help. Do you know this troop?"
"Somewhat. I did a bit of work for them this winter, fixing buckles and such like. I'm a smith, you see."
It was Madden's turn to stare. What was a smith doing out in the middle of a wilderness? Then it occurred to him that Otho might have some dishonour of his own behind him.
"Now, Caradoc, that's their leader, isn't a bad man considering what he is," Otho went on. "He wants me to ride south with him when they go. I've been thinking it over."
While Athan watered the horses, Otho went into his cabin, then reappeared wearing a leather vest over his tunic and carrying a different axe, one with a long handle banded with metal and obviously made as a weapon, which he used to good advantage for clearing brush and overhanging branches. The trail was so narrow and twisty that the men had to lead their horses. It was about the middle of the afternoon when they came into a vast clearing of some 5 acres and saw the high stone walls of what once had been a noble's hunting lodge. The wooden gates were long since rotted away, letting them see the broch, still in reasonable repair, and a collection of tumble-down sheds inside. As they walked up, Caradoc himself came out to meet them. Otho introduced him, a tall, slender man with the long, ropey arms of a born swordsman and the high cheekbones and pale hair of a southern man. He seemed about Athan's age, in his mid-30s, and for all that he was a dishonoured man, there was something impressive about Caradoc. The proud way he stood, the shrewd way he looked men over with eyes that seemed to have seen a lot of life.
"Since you're looking for bodies to sell," Otho said, "I brought you a couple."
"Interesting."
Caradoc gave them each a pleasant smile. "Here's Athan with a Cantrey boar on his shirt, and Mathin dressed like a farmer but carrying a sword. I looked like the pair of you once. Left a warband down in Caermore a bit. Well, sudden-like. Never did bid a proper farewell to my lord. I'll wager, Athan, that the scars on your back, judging from the stains on your shirt..."
"More than a few. Cursed if I'll tell you why."
"I'd never ask. Now, here's the terms, lads. I'll take anyone on for a summer. If you can't fight, then you'll die in a scrap and we'll be rid of you. If you can fight, then you'll get an equal share of the coin. And remember, I'm the leader of this pack of dogs. You give me one bit of trouble, and I'll beat the shit out of you. Scribe that deep into your ugly hearts. You ride at orders, or you don't ride."
It was obvious that Caradoc meant what he said as soon as they went into the dun. Instead of the bandit-like pile of filth that Mathin had been dreading, the camp was as clean as a great lord's barracks. There were 36 men in the troop, and their gear was well tended, their horses good healthy stock, and their discipline tighter, in fact, than that of Mathin's old warband. As Caradoc introduced the new recruits around, the other members of the band paid him such strict and respectful attention that Mathen began to wonder if he were noble-born. Otho came along with them, listening to Caradoc and stroking his beard in thought, but he said not a word until they all went outside again so that Mathen and Aethon could unsaddle their horses and unload their gear.
"Well, Otho," Caradoc said, "we'll be pulling out soon. Coming with us to Eldith?" "I might at that. I've gotten used to a bit of company, especially company that can pay a smith better than the stinking bondsman in this forest."
"So we can, and you'll like Eldith well enough once we get there."
"Ha, I've got my doubts about that. They always say that there's elven blood in Eldith veins."
"Not that again."
Caradoc mugged a doleful expression. "As much as I admire your craft, good smith, I have to say that your wits are a bit thin in places. Elves, indeed."
"Mock all you want, but elven blood makes a man unreliable."
"It'd make any man unreliable to have a myth in his clan's quarterings."
Caradoc ran one finger down the silvery blade of Otho's axe.
"But talk about elves all you want, just so long as you keep working your witchcraft on metals. When we're all as rich as lords and the most famous free troop in all of Deveri, you're going to make us swords out of that warlock's metal of yours."
"Ha! You'd have to be a king to afford that, my friend. You'll be blasted lucky if you ever get rich enough to have so much as a dagger out of it."
After Mathen and Aethon had their horses settled and fed in the stables, one of the men, Stevik by name, came to help them carry their gear into the broch. When he picked up the big leather bag that held Madin's harp, he broke into a grin.
"Which one of you is the bard?"
"I am," Mathen said, "but not so much of one, a girthin truly, if that. I can sing, but I don't have a true bard's lore."
"And who gives a pig's fart who some lord's great-great-great-grandam was? This is a bit of splendid luck."
Stevik turned, calling out to Caradoc.
"Here, captain, we've got a bard of our own.
And next we'll be eating off of silver plates like the great lords we are."
Caradoc came strolling over.
"But a bard would have come in handy this winter, with the pack of you causing trouble because you had naught better to do." "Well and good then, Mathen. If you sing well enough, you'll be free of kitchen work and stable duty. But I'll expect you to make up songs about our battles just like you would for a lord."
"I'll do my best, captain, to sing as well as we deserve."
"Better than we deserve, Mathen lad, or you'll sound like a cat in heat."
After a rough dinner of venison and turnips, Mathen was given his chance to sing, sitting on a rickety, half-rotted table in what had once been the lodge's great hall. He'd only done one ballad when he realized that his place in the troop was assured. The men listened with the deep fascination of the utterly bored, hardly noticing or caring when he got a bit off-key or stumbled over a line. After a winter with naught but dice games and the blacksmith's daughter for entertainment, they cheered him as if he were the best bard at the king's court. They made him sing until he was hoarse that night, and let him stop only reluctantly then. Only Mathen and Otho knew, of course, that the hall was filled with wild folk, listening as intently as the men. That night, Mathen lay awake for a long time and listened to the familiar sound of other men snoring close by in the darkness of a barracks. He was back in a war band, back in his old life so firmly that he wondered if he'd dreamt those enchanted months in Bryn Taradic. The winter behind him seemed like a lost paradise, when he'd had good company and a woman of his own, when he'd had a glimpse of a wider, freer world of peace and Dweoma, a little glimpse only. Then the door had been slammed in his face. He was back in the war. A dishonored rider, whose one goal in life was to earn the respect of other dishonored men. At least Belian was going to have his baby back in Cantrae, a small life who would outlive him and would be better off as a farmer than his father would be as a warrior. Thinking about the babe, he could fall asleep at last, smiling to himself. On the day that Mathen left Bryn Taradic, Nevin spent a good many hours shutting up the caves for the summer and loading herbs and medicines into the canvas mule packs. He had a journey of over 900 miles ahead of him, with stops along the way that were crucial to the success of his long-range plans. If he were to succeed in making a Dweoma king to bring peace to the country, he would need help from powerful friends, particularly among the priesthoods. He would also need to find a man of royal blood worthy of his plans, and that, or so he told himself, might well be the most difficult part of the work. The first week of his journey was easy. Although the Cantrey roads were full of warbands, mustering to begin the ride to Dundevery for the summer's fighting, no one bothered him, seemingly only a shabby old herdman with his ambling mule, his patched brown cloak, and the white hair that the local riders respected as a sign of his great age. He followed the Caniver down to its joining with the River Nur, near the town of Muir, a place that held memories some 200 years old. As he always did when he passed through Muir, he went into the last patch of wild forest, now the hunting preserve of the Southern Boar clan. In the midst of a stand of old oaks was an ancient, mossy cairn that marked the grave of Bronwyn of the Falcon, the woman he had loved, wronged, and lost so many years ago. He always felt somewhat of a fool for making this pilgrimage. Her body was long decayed, and her soul had been reborn several times since that miserable day when he dug this grave and helped pile up these rocks. Yet the sight meant something to him still, because, if for no other reason, it was a place where he'd sworn the rash vow that was the cause of his unnaturally long life. Out of respect for a grave, even though they could have no idea of whose it was, the boar's gamekeepers had left the cairn undisturbed. Nevin was pleased to see that someone had even tended it by replacing a few fallen stones and pulling the weeds away from its base. It was a small act of decency, in a world where decency was in danger of vanishing. For some time he sat on the ground and watched the dappled forest light playing on the cairn, while he wondered when he would find Bronwyn's soul again. His meditation brought him a small insight. She was reborn, but still a child. Eventually, he was sure, in some way Mathin would lead him to her. In life after life, his weird had been linked to hers, and indeed, in his last life, he had followed her to the death, binding a chain of weird tight around them both. After he left Muir, Nevin rode west to Dundevery for a first-hand look at the man who claimed to be king in the Holy City. On a hot spring day, when the sun lay as thick as the dust in the road, he came to the shores of the Gwer Conneth, the vast lake formed by the confluence of three rivers, and let his horse and mule rest for a moment by the reedy shore. He was joined by a pair of young priests of Bel, shaven-headed and dressed in linen tunics, who were also travelling to the Holy City. After a pleasant chat, they all decided to ride in together.
"And who's the High Priest these days?" Nevin asked. "I've been living up in Cantrey, so I'm badly out of touch."
"His Holiness, Gwergovin," said the elder of the pair.
"I see."
Nevin's heart sank. He remembered Gwergovian all too well as a spiritual ferret of a man.
"And tell me summat else. I've heard that the boars of Cantrey are the men to watch in court circles."
Even though they were all alone on the open road, the young priest lowered his voice when he answered.
"They are, truly, and there are plenty who grumble about it, too. I know His Holiness thinks rather sourly of the men of the boar."
At length they came to the city, which rose high on its four hills behind massive double rings of stone walls, ramparted and towered. The wooden gates, carved with a wyvern rampant, were bound with iron, and guards in thickly embroidered shirts stood to either side. Yet as soon as Nevin went inside, the impression of splendour vanished. Once a prosperous city had filled these walls. Now house after house stood abandoned, with weed-choked yards and empty windows, the thatch blowing rotten in dirty streets. Much of the city lay in outright ruin, heaps of stone among rotting, charred timbers. It had been taken by siege so many times in the last 100 years, then taken back by the sword, that apparently no one had the strength, the coin, or the hope to rebuild. In the centre of the city, around and between two main hills, lived what was left of the population, scarcely more than in King Bran's time. Warriors walked the streets and shoved the townsfolk aside whenever they met. It seemed to Nevin that every man he saw was a rider for one lord or another, and every woman either lived in fear of them or had surrendered to the inevitable and turned whore to please them. The first inn he found was tiny, dirty and ramshackle, little more than a big house divided into a tavern room and a few chambers, but he lodged there because he liked the innkeep, Drowth, a slender old man with hair as white as Nevin's and a smile that showed an almost superhuman ability to keep a sense of humour in the midst of ruin. When he found out that Nevin was a herbman, Drowth insisted on taking out his lodging in trade.
"Well, after all, I'm as old as you are, so I'll easily equal the cost in your herbs. Why give me coins only to have me give them right back?" "True spoken. Ah, old age. Here, I've studied the human body all my life, but I swear old age has put pains in my joints I never knew existed."
Nevin spent that first afternoon in the tavern, dispensing herbs for Drowth's collection of ailments, and hearing in return all the local gossip, which meant royal gossip. In Dundevery, even the poorest person knew what there was to know about the goings-on at court. Gossip was their bard, and the royalty their only source of pride. Drowth was a particularly rich source, because his youngest daughter, now a woman in her 40s, worked up in the palace kitchens, where she had plenty of opportunities to overhear the noble-born servitors, like the chamberlain and steward, at their gossip. From what Drowth repeated that day, the boars were so firmly in control of the king that it was something of a scandal. Everyone said that Tibrin, the boar of Cantrey, was close to being the real king himself.
"And now, with the king so ill, our poor liege, and his wife so young, and Tibrin a widower and all..."
Drowth paused for dramatic effect.
"Well, can't you imagine what we folk are wondering?" "Indeed I can. But would the priests allow the king's widow to marry?"
Drowth rubbed his thumb and forefinger together like a merchant gloating over a coin.
"Ah, by the hells," Nevin snarled. "Has it gotten as bad as all that? There's naught left but coin to bribe the priests with. They've already gotten every land grant and legal concession they want."
At that point, Nevin decided that meeting with Gwergovin, if indeed he could even get in to see him, was a waste of time.
"But what ails the king? He's still a young man. He took a bad wound in the fighting last summer. I happened to be out on the royal road when they brought him home. I'd been buying eggs at the market when I heard the bustle and the horns coming, and I saw the king lying in a litter, and he was as pale as snow, he was. But he lived, when here we all thought they'd be putting his little lad on the throne come winter. But he never did heal up right. My daughter tells me that he has to have special food, like, all soft food and none of them bardic spices, neither. So they boil the meat soft and pulp apples and such like."
Nevin was completely puzzled. The special diet made no sense at all for a man who, by all accounts, had been wounded in the chest. He began to wonder if someone were deliberately keeping the king weak, perhaps to gain the good favour of Tibrin of the Boar. The best way to find out, of course, was to talk to the king's physicians. On the morrow, he took his laden mule up to the palace, which lay on the northern hill. Ring after ring of defensive walls, some stone, some earthworks, marched up the slope and cut the hill into defensible slices. At every gate and every wall, guards stopped Nevin and asked him his business, but they always let a man with healing herbs to sell pass on through. Finally, at the top, behind one last ring, stood the palace and all its outbuildings and servant quarters. Like a stork among chickens, a six-story broch, ringed by four lower half-brochs, rose in the centre. If the outer defences fell, the attackers would have to fight their way through a warren of corridors and rooms to get at the king himself. In all the years of war, the palace had never fallen to force, only to starvation. The last guard called a servant lad, who ran off to the royal infirmary with the news that a herbman waited outside. After a wait of some 5 minutes, he ran back and led Nevin to a big round stone building behind the Brock complex. There they were met by a burly man with dark eyes that glared under bushy brows, as if their owner were in a state of constant fury. But when he introduced himself as Grodin, the head chirurgeon, he was soft-spoken enough.
"An herbman's always welcome. Come, spread out your wares, good sir. That table by the window would be best, I think, right in the light and fresh air."
While Nevin laid out packets of dried herbs, tree barks and sliced dried roots, Grodrin fetched his apprentice, Cordier, a sandy-haired young man with narrow blue eyes and a jaw so sharply modelled it looked as if it could cut cheese. He also had a club foot, which gave him the rolling walk of a sailor. Between them, the two chirurgeons sorted through his wares, and for starters set aside his entire stock of valerian, elecampane, and comfrey root.
"I don't suppose you ever get down to the seacoast," Grodin said, in a carefully casual tone of voice.
"Well, this summer I'm thinking of trying to slip through the battle lines. Usually the armies don't much care about one old man. Is there summat you need from the sea?"
"Red kelp, if you can get it, and some sea moss."
"They work wonders to soothe an ulcerated stomach or bad bowels."
Nevin hesitated briefly.
"Here, I've heard rumours about this peculiar so-called wound of our liege the king."
"So-called?"
Grodin paid busy attention to the packet of beech bark in his hand.
"A wound in the chest that requires him to eat only soft food."
Grodin looked up with a twisted little smile.
"It was poison, of course. The wound healed splendidly. While he was still weak, someone put poison into his mead. We saved him after a long fight of it, but his stomach is ulcerated and bleeding, just as you guessed, and there's blood in his stool, too. But we're trying to keep the news from the common people."
"Oh, I won't go bruiting it about, I assure you. Do you have any idea of what this poison was?"
"None. Now here, you know herbs. What do you think this might be? When he vomited, there was a sweetish smell hanging about the basin, rather like roses mixed with vinegar. It was grotesque to find a poison that smelled of perfume. But the strangest thing was this. The king's page had tasted the mead and suffered not the slightest ill effect. Yet I know it was in the mead, because the dregs in the goblet had an odd rosy colour."
Nevin thought for a long moment, running over the long chains of lore in his memory.
"Well," he said at last, "I can't name the herbs out, but I'll wager they came originally from Bardic. I've heard that poisoners there often use two different evil essences, each harmless in themselves. The page at table doubtless got a dose of the first one when he tasted the king's mead, and the page of the chamber got the other. The king, alas, got both, and they combined into venom in his stomach."
As he nodded his understanding, Grodin looked half sick with such an honest rage that Nevin mentally acquitted him of any part in the crime. Cordia, too, looked deeply troubled.
"I've made special studies of the old herbals we have," the young chirurgeon said, "and we never found this beastly poison. If it came from Bardic, that would explain it."
"So it would," Nevin said. "Well, good sirs, I'll do my best to get you the red kelp and what other emollients I can, but it'll be autumn before I return. Will our liege live that long?"
"If no one poisons him again."
Grodin tossed the packet of beech bark onto the table.
"Ah, ye gods, can you imagine how helpless I feel? Here I am fighting to undo the effects of one poison, while someone is doubtless scheming out a way to slip him a second."
"Wasn't there any inquiry into this poisoning?"
"Of course."
Abruptly, Grodin turned guarded.
"It found out naught, though. We suspect a Caermore spy."
"Oh, I'll just wager you do," Nevin thought to himself. "That is, if there are boars in Caermore, anyway."
Their business over, Nevin put on a good show of expressing the gossipy interest that any visitor to the palace would have in seeing the place where the king lived. Cordia, who seemed to be a good-hearted lad, took him on a tour of the semi-public gardens and outbuildings. It took only the slightest touch of Nevin's dwayoma to sense that the palace was filled with corruption. The omen came to him as the smell of rotting meat and the sight of maggots crawling between the stones. He banished the vision as quickly as he could. The point was well made. As they were walking to the front gate, they saw a noble hunting party returning. Guerbrit Tibrin of the Boar, with a retinue of servants and huntsmen behind him, and his widowed sister at his side. As Nevin led his mule off to the side out of the way of the noble-born, he noticed Cordia watching the Lady Marotha wistfully. Just 20, the lady had long blonde hair bound up in soft twists under the black headscarf of a widow, wide green eyes, and features that were perfect without being cold. She was truly beautiful. But as he watched her, Nevin loathed her.
Although he couldn't pinpoint his reasons, he'd never seen a woman he found so repellent. Cordia was obviously of the opposite opinion. Much to Nevin's surprise, when Marotha rode past, she favoured Cordia with a brilliant smile and a wave of her delicately gloved hand. Cordia bowed deeply in return.
"Now here, lad," Nevin said with a chuckle. "You're knocking an arrow for rather high-born game."
"Don't I just know it? I could be as noble as she is, but I'd still be deformed."
"Oh, my apologies. I meant naught of that sort."
"I know, good sir, I know. I fear me that years of being mocked has made me touchy."
Cordia bowed and hurried away with his rolling, dragging limp. Nevin was heartsick over his lapse. It was a hard thing to be handicapped in a world where women and men both worshipped warriors. Later that day, however, he found out that Cordia bore him no ill will. Just after sunset, Cordia came to Nevin's inn, insisted on buying him a tankard, and sat them both down at a table in a corner, far from the door.
"I was wondering about your stock of herbs, good Nevin. You wouldn't happen to have any northern elm bark, would you?"
"Now here, I don't traffic in abortifacients, lad."
Cordia winced and began studying the interior of his tankard.
"Ah, well," the lad said at last, "the bark's a blasted sight safer than henbane."
"No doubt. But the question is why you're doing abortions at all. I should think that every babe these days would be precious."
"Not if it's sired by your husband. Here, please don't despise me. There's a lot of noblewomen who spend all summer at court, and, well, their husbands are off on campaign for months at a time, and, well, you know how things happen, and, well, they come to me in tears and
shower you with silver, no doubt. It's not the coin." "Indeed? What is it, then? The only time in your life that women have come begging you for summat?"
When tears welled in Cordia's eyes, Nevin regretted his harsh accuracy. He looked away to give the young chirurgeon a chance to wipe his face. It was the infidelities more than the abortions that bothered Nevin. The thought of noble women, whose restricted life gave them nothing but their honour to take pride in, turning first to illicit affairs, then to covering them over, made him feel that the kingdom was rotting from the centre out. As for the abortions, the Dwayoma law teaches that a soul comes to indwell a fetus only in the fourth or fifth month after conception. Any abortion before that time is only removing a lump of flesh, not a living child. By the time a noblewoman was in her fifth month, Nevin supposed, her indiscretion would be known already, and so doubtless Cordia was solving their little problems long before the fetus was truly alive.
"Now one moment."
Nevin was struck by a sudden thought.
"You're not using ergot, are you, you stupid little dolt?"
"Never."
Cordia's rose in a sincere squeak.
"And all the dangers of that?"
"Good. All it would take is for one of your noble patients to die or go mad, and then you'd be up to your neck in a tub of horseshit, good and proper."
"I know, but if I didn't find the right herbs for these ladies, they'd be cast off by their husbands, and probably end up smothering the babe anyway, or they'd go to some old witch of a farm wife, and then they would die."
"You split hairs so well, you should have been a priest."
Cordia tried to smile and failed utterly, looking like a child who's just been scolded when he honestly didn't know he'd done a wrong thing. Suddenly, Nevin felt the Dwayoma power gathering round him, filling his mouth with words that burned straight out of the future.
"You can't keep this sort of thing quiet. When the king dies, his murderers will need a scapegoat. It's going to be you, because of this midnight physic you've been dispensing. Live ready to flee at the first sign that the king is sinking. Can Tibrin of the Boar find out about your unsavoury herbs?"
"He could. The Lady Marotha. I mean, hey, ye gods, who are you, old man?"
"Can't you tell Dwayoma when you hear it? The Boar will take his sister's evidence, turn it against you, and have you broken on the wheel to avert suspicion from himself. If I were you, I'd leave well before the end comes, or they'll hunt you down as a regicide."
Cordia jerked to his feet so fast that he toppled both his tankard and Nevin's, then fled, racing out of the tavern door. Although old Drouth gave Nevin a questioning look, he also shrugged as if to say it was none of his affair. Nevin retrieved the tankards from the floor, then turned on the bench so that he could look directly into the peat fire smouldering on the tavern hearth.
As soon as he bent his mind to Adarin, his old apprentice's image appeared with his enormous dark eyes and his grey hair swept up in two peaks at his forehead like the horns of a silver owl.
"And how's your scheme progressing?"
Adarin thought to him.
"Well enough, I suppose. I've learned one very important thing. I'd rather die than put any Cantre king on the throne. Is it as bad as all that?" "The palace stinks like the biggest dung heap on the hottest day of the longest summer. I can't see how any young soul could grow up there without being corrupted from birth. I'm not even going to bother talking to the priests here. They're corrupt too, and doubtless in new and unusual ways. I haven't seen you this angry in about 100 years. Nought's been so vexing in 100 years. The most honourable man I've met here is an abortionist. Does that give you a hint?"
Floating about the fire, Adarin's image rolled its eyes heavenward in disgust. Caradoc and his band of mercenaries left the deserted hunting lodge soon after Mathen and Aethon joined the troop. Although everyone was speculating about where they would go, the captain told no one until the morning of their departure. Once the men were mounted and formed up in neat ranks that would have done the King's Guard credit, Caradoc inspected them carefully, then pulled his horse up to face them.
"It's Eldith, lads. We've got too many men who can't let themselves be seen around Dundevery to take a hire on Slimar's side, and I don't dare to be seen in Caermore. I've hoarded some coin from the winter, seeing as our lodging was free and all, so I think we can ride straight there."
Although no one cheered this prospect of leaving home for a foreign land, no one muttered in discontent either. Caradoc paused as if waiting for grumblers, then shrugged and raised his hand.
"Otho the Smith's meeting us on the road with a wagon. Forward, march!"
With a jingle of tack, the troop executed a perfect turn in ranks and began to file out the Dun Gate, two by two. As a mark of honour to a bard, Mathen rode next to Caradoc at the head of the line. Over the next few days, as they worked their way southwest as quickly as possible, he had plenty of chances to study his new leader. The biggest puzzle that ate at his bardic curiosity was whether or not Caradoc was noble-born. At times, when the captain was discussing some point of the royal law or giving orders with his firm authority, Mathen was sure that he must have been born the younger son of a lord. Yet, when it came to coin, he had all the grasping shrewdness of an old peasant woman, an attitude he never would have learned among the nobility. Occasionally, Mathen dropped hints or half-questions about the past into their conversation, but Caradoc never rose to the bait. When the troop camped for the night, Caradoc ate alone like a lord, and Mathen shared a fire with Aethon and a small crowd of wild folk. After a week of riding, the troop crossed the Aver Trebic at a point about 100 miles west of Dundevery. Caradoc gave orders that the men were to ride armed and ready for trouble. He sent out point men and scouts ahead of the main body of riders because they were approaching the border between Caermore-held and Cantre-held territory. The precautions paid off with a rather strange prize. On the second day of riding armed, when they were finally getting close to the Eldith border, the troop stopped for the noon rest in a grassy meadow that had never known plough or herd. When the pointmen came back to change the guard, they brought with them a traveller, an unarmed man with rich clothing, a beautiful riding horse, and an elegant pack mule that had obviously been bred from the best stock. Mathen was surprised that the poor dolt had survived unrobbed for as long as he had. The young sandy-haired fellow looked so terrified that Mathen supposed he was thinking similar thoughts.
"He says he comes from Dundevery," the point man said, "so we brought him along in case he had any interesting news."
"Good," Caradoc said. "Now look, young fellow, we're not going to slit your throat or even rob you. Come have a meal with me and Mathen here."
With a most discourteous groan, the stranger looked around at the well-armed troop, then sighed in resignation.
"So I will, then. My name's, Claith."
Caradoc and Mathen each suppressed a grin at the clumsiness of the lie. When the stranger dismounted, Mathen saw that he had a club foot, which seemed to ache him after so many days in the saddle. As they shared a meal of flatbread and cheese, the supposed Claith told them what little he knew about the troop movements around the Holy City. The current rumour was that the northern forces were planning to make a strong strike along the eastern borders of the Caermore Kingdom.
"If that's true,"
Caradoc said thoughtfully.
"We'll have no trouble getting a hire in Eldith. Probably the Eldith King will want to take the chance to raid into Pierden."
"Oh-ho!" Claith said. "Then you're a free troop. Well, that's a relief."
"Oh, is it now? Most men would think the opposite."
Caradoc shook his head, as if he were utterly amazed at the innocence of this lad.
"Well and good, then. Who's chasing you? It's safe to tell me. I've sunk pretty low, lad, but not so low that I'd turn a man in for the bounty on his head."
Claith concentrated on shredding a piece of flatbread into inedible crumbs.
"You don't have to tell me if you don't want to," Caradoc said after a moment. "But think about travelling with us. You'll be a blasted sight safer. Ever had a fancy to see Eldith?"
"That's where I was trying to go, and you're right enough about it being safer. I've never swung a sword in my life. I'm a scholar."
"Splendid. Maybe I'll need a letter written some fine day."
Although Claith managed a feeble smile at the jest, his face stayed deadly pale. Yet when the troop rode out, he came with them, riding by himself just behind Otho's wagon. At the night camp, Madin took pity on him and offered to let him share their fire. Although he brought out food from his mule packs, Claith ate little of it, merely sat quietly and watched Aethon polishing his sword. When, after the meal, Caradoc strolled over for a chat, Claith again said little, as the captain and the bard talked idly of their plans in Eldith. Finally, though, at a pause, he spoke up.
"I've been thinking about your offer, Captain. Could you use a troop, Kyrgyn? I finished my apprenticeship only a year ago, but I've had an awful lot of practice at tending wounds."
"By all the ice in all the hells," Madin said, "you're worth your weight in gold."
"Cursed right."
Caradoc cocked his head to one side and considered the young Kyrgyn.
"Now, I'm not a curious man usually, and I like to leave my lads their privacy like, but in your case I've got to ask. What's a man with your learning doing travelling the long, lonely roads like this?"
"You might as well know the truth. First of all, my name's Cordia, and I was at the court in Dundevery. I mixed up a few potions and such like for some high-born ladies to rid them of, trouble now and again. The word's gotten out about it in rather a nasty way."
Caradoc and Aethon exchanged a puzzled glance.
"He means abortions," Madin said with a grin. "Naught that should vex us, truly."
"Might even come in handy with this pack of dogs I've got," Caradoc said.
"Well and good then, Cordia. Once you've shown me that you can physic a man, you'll get a full share of our earnings, just like a rider. I've discovered that a lord's Kyrgyn tends his lord's men first, and the mercenaries when he has a mind to, and not before. I've had men bleed to death who would have lived if they'd gotten the proper attention."
Idly, Madin happened to glance Aethon's way to find him staring at Cordia in grim suspicion.
"Up in Dundevery, were you?"
Aethon's voice was a dry, hard whisper.
"Was one of your high-born ladies, Marotha of the Boar?"
In a confession stronger than words, Cordia winced, then blushed. Aethon got to his feet, hesitated, then took off running into the darkness.
"What by the hells?" Caradoc snapped.
Without bothering to explain, Madin got up and followed, chasing Aethon through the startled camp, pounding blindly after him through the moonshot night down to the river bank. Finally, Aethon stopped and let him catch up. They stood together for a long time, panting for breath and watching the silver-touched river flow by.
"With a bitch like that," Madin said finally, "how would you even know that the babe was yours?" "I kept my eye on her like a hawk all winter long. If she'd looked at another man, I'd have killed him, and she knew it."
With a sigh, Madin sat down, and after a moment, Aethon joined him.
"Having a Kyrgyn of our own will be a cursed good thing," Madin said. "Can you put up with Cordia? Who's blaming him for one single thing? I wish I could kill her. I dream about it sometimes, getting my hands on her pretty white throat and strangling her."
Abruptly, Aethon turned and threw himself into Madin's arms. Madin held him tightly and let him cry, the choking, ugly sob of a man who feels shamed by tears. 2 days later, the troop crossed the border into Eldith.
At that time, the northern part of the province was nearly a wilderness, forests and wild grasslands broken only by the occasional dun of a minor lord or a village of free farmers. Plenty of the lords would have liked to hire the troop, because they were in constant danger of raids coming either from the kingdom of Pierdon to the north or from Deveri to the east. None, however, could pay Caradoc what he considered the troop was worth. With 37 men, their own smith, Cairgeon and Bard, the troop was bigger than the warbands of most of the lords in northern Eldith. Just when Caradoc was beginning to curse his decision to ride that way, the troop reached the new town of Caminwain, on the banks of an oddly named river, the El, just as the spot where the even more strangely named Avacanterial flows in from the northwest. Although there had been a farming village on the site for centuries, only 20 years before had the Gwerbret in Elrith decided that the kingdom needed a proper town at the joining of the rivers. Since the war with Pierdon could flare up at any time, he wanted a staging ground for troops and a properly defensible set of walls around it. Finding colonists was no problem, because there were plenty of younger sons of noble lords willing to risk a move to gain land of their own, and plenty of bondsmen willing to go with them since they became free men once they left their bound land. When Caradoc's troop rode into Caminwain, they found a decent town of 1,000 round houses behind high stone walls, turreted with watchtowers. About a mile away was the stone dun of Tyrin Mainowick, and there Caradoc found the kind of hire he'd been looking for. Although Mainowick received maintenance from the Gwerbret to the south, there was a shortage of fighting men in his vast domain, and he had a private war on his hands. Since the authority of his clan was fairly new, he was always plagued with rebellions. For years now, the chief troublemaker had been a certain Lord Pagwill.
"And he's gathered together a lot of bastards like himself," Mainowick said. "And they claim they'll ask the Gwerbret to give them a tyrant of their own and not submit to me. I can't stand for it."
He couldn't, truly, because standing for it would not only take half his land away, but also make him the laughingstock of every man in Eldith. A stout, hard-muscled man, with a thick streak of grey in his raven-dark hair, Mainowick was steaming with fury as he strode back and forth, looking over the troop, who were sitting on their horses outside the gates to Mainowick's dun. Caradoc and Madden followed a respectful distance behind, while the lord judged the troop's horses and gear with a shrewd eye.
"Very well, Captain. A silver piece per week per man, your maintenance, and of course I'll replace any horses that you lose."
"Most generous, my lord," Caradoc said. "For peacetime."
Mainowick turned to scowl at him.
"Another silver piece per man for every battle we fight," Caradoc went on. "And that's paid for every man who dies, too."
"Far too much."
"As it pleases your lordship. Me and my men can just ride on."
"And over to your enemies, perhaps?" The thought hung unspoken between them for a long moment. Finally, Mainowick swore under his breath.
"Done, then. A second silver piece per man for every scrap."
With an open and innocent smile, Caradoc bowed to him. Mainowick's new-built dun was large enough to have two sets of barracks and stables built into the walls, a blessing, because the mercenaries could be well separated from Mainowick's contemptuous warband. At meals, though, they shared the same set of tables, and the warband made barely tolerable comments about men who fought for money, and quite intolerable comments about the parentage and character of such who did so. Between them, Caradoc and Mainowick broke up 7 different fistfights in 2 days before the army was at last ready to ride out. After he called in his loyal allies, Mainowick had over 250 men to lead west against his rebels. In the line of march, Caradoc's troop came at the very end, behind even the supply wagons, and ate dust all day long. At night they made camp by themselves a little way off from the warbands of the noble-born. Caradoc, however, was summoned when the lords held a council of war. He came back to the troop with solid news and gathered them around him to hear it.
"Tomorrow we'll see the first scrap. Here's how things stand, lads. We're coming to a river and there's a bridge there. Mainowick claims the taxes on it, but Pagwell's holding out. The scouts say Pagwell's going to make a stand to prevent the tyrant from crossing, because once he crosses against Pagwell's will, it's his bridge again in everybody's eyes. We'll be leading the charge, of course."
Everyone nodded, acknowledging that they were, after all, the disposable mercenaries. Madin found himself troubled by a strange feeling, a coldness, a heaviness. It took him a long time to admit it, but then he realized that he was quite simply afraid. That night he dreamt of his last charge up in Cantray, and woke soaked with cold sweat.
"You coward," he told himself, "you ugly little..."